What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fudge Muppet. I'm Scott here with Michael and Drew. As always, this is the Elder Scrolls podcast, and today we're back with more Elder Scrolls theories. We've taken comments from the previous installment of the theories podcast episode, and now we're going to sort of scan through. We're kind of going in blind too. We don't want to come with like an essay of preparation. We want the sort of, you know, free flow of ideas and pondering, you know, that first little lightning bolt that hits your head when you read something for the first time. So where would we like to start?
Well, I think the top comment is the obvious one, because we said commented on the theories video. So if I'm going there and looking, theory by EJ Dubs: the lust the Argonian made led to spears being banned throughout Cyrodiil. That's why the most common weapon in human history mysteriously did not appear in later games. Discuss.
Damn. Damn.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's as good a theory as any.
The Empire, like, delete this now.
How about instead we do a theory that's...
Whoa. Are you trying to silence? He's trying to silence the truth. It's finally been revealed. Silence.
He's got his red on. Empire colors, classic.
That's it.
Look.
Okay, here's one from Aaron M. Says, I've got two theories. Well, let's just do the first one, because I didn't realize there was two theories yet. Maik the Liar is Rajin, or at least an aspect of Rajin. He's been around since the Second Era and always makes fun of the current events happening in the land. Maik already had different looks in each game, which could be explained by him taking a new form in each game. Maik says that his father is called Maik too, but don't trust a guy that is called Maik the Liar and in every era. But I think that's kind of, like, you could probably work with that in the way that, like, beyond, obviously, Maik the Liar is an Easter egg, right? But if you had him as some sort of, like, aspect of a trickster deity among the Khajiit or something.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I feel like the only real connection you can draw is the fact they're Khajiit. Let's be honest here.
Yeah, but is there a trickster? Like, to be honest, I don't think Rajin is actually the best fit, because he's not a trickster. He's a thief.
Well,
he's stealing is more so his...
I guess he is a trickster. Rajin is literally called the trickster god.
He is?
Yeah.
But nothing... What does he do? Well, I guess thievery in ways are like tricks.
He,
like,
has these shadows in Elder Scrolls Online just called, like, Rajin's shadows, and they go around causing mischief, which aligns more with this theory.
Just to give you a good idea of why I think this theory is terrible, is you can kind of apply this. You can apply this logic.
Because you love Rajin.
You can apply this logic to anyone. So I just looked up Bandar, who is their bandit god, and he's known as the Man of a Thousand Faces. If you're going to have anyone, any Khajiit god who is also Maik, then it might as well be the one who can supposedly shift its face to appear like different Khajiit.
You just don't want it to be Rajin because you like Rajin, and then you don't like Maik.
I just genuinely, this is a case of like, oh, Khajiit must be another Khajiit, because all Khajiit, you know, it's
no,
like...
No, but like, obviously, okay, so I guess, but getting foundational here, I didn't think I'd have to do this, but getting foundational here, Maik the Liar appears, you know, through multiple games as this Easter egg, and he doesn't seem to be the same character every time, or you wonder, you know, how is he living for so long, so on and so forth. And he tells lies, right? Like, he's mischievous.
To be honest, I actually prefer the idea that he is an aspect of some deity versus, like, other theories I've seen where it's like, oh, he's immortal this, or it's some family tradition thing, which seems far memeier to me or something. And I feel like there's been, you know, there's plenty of beings where there's been that sort of indirect aspect kind of feel, like, you know, with Wolf of Talos Sanguine. And
this is my point, is it's like he's been around in all these games. Yeah, okay, he's just an Easter egg. But what sounds more likely in a fantasy world? That there's a tradition where there's these Khajiit who just roam around Tamriel using the same name, telling lies to people? Or... because it's an aspect of a god. I know it sounds far-fetched, but like, we're talking about a fantasy universe here.
If that were the case, I just would say he's his own god. It's just a god that isn't really recognized.
The reason Khajiit is, well, I mean, he is manifesting as a Khajiit in it consistently throughout the games, in no matter what province. But that wouldn't that make, oh, maybe Khajiit god, in the same way that other Khajiit gods, like, you know, like Shea Gorath, even, you know, manifest as an Alfeek, or if you were to go like, oh, Sun, oh, he's going to be a Nord. He's going to be like an Atmoran kind of looking
the
thing.
The connection we're drawing is because he's a thief, he's also a liar, so therefore he's probably also the liar you see wandering around. I feel like if,
but there's a metaphysical aspect.
If you're going to get into the... like, this is the most famous burglar in Khajiit history. It's like their most well-known cultural icon. Yeah. And his aspect, his one aspect after death, is some random Khajiit who wanders the wild who nobody knows.
I don't think you're coming at this with an open mind, because I can I can tell by your voice that you really don't want it to be like confirmed, because you're like, you're like, Rajin and Maik, they're separate.
I feel like it's like someone came along and said, one of Scott's favorite deities is like Nazim, and that Nazim's an aspect of him, and or something
like
that.
Nazim's an aspect of Mafal,
and you're
something.
No, they're different.
Well, okay, yeah, so that's essentially, that is my argument, is that just because you can draw a connection, because like, both speak in Tamriel, they both speak English, or you know, whatever language they're speaking there, therefore they must be them. It's drawing connections based on nothing. There's no
to distinguish it a little bit extra, though. It is because there is some sort of metaphysical element around Maik the Liar, that he keeps this Maik the Liar character whose personality is basically the same all throughout the game, seems to be the same being, might look a little different, whatever, keeps appearing throughout time and so on. So the idea that you, if you had some sort of like being that feels a little like metaphysical, or something magical is going on, connecting it as an aspect.
I'm not failing to understand any of this. The part I'm asking, right, is why Rajin?
Because it's a Khajiit trickster.
He's a thief trickster god.
So his big trick. He's done all these wonderful... He's done these incredible things. Like stealing artifacts off the arm of Mafala. Things like that. Stealing a tattoo off someone's neck. And now he's like... my ultimate plan is I'm going to walk around in the mountains and say random riddles to strangers.
His heyday's done. He's like, this is retirement.
To be fair, if you do look at the Elder Scrolls Online lore and you look at these kind of these shadows, they kind of just look like ethereal beings walking around representing different aspects of Rajin. They do kind of, like, here's an example. Like, one of Rajin's shadows granted a wish to a bard who wanted the power to seduce any person he wished with music. And so he gave him this magical lyre. That's what you call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That instrument, L-Y-R-E. Like, Maik the Lyre? Anyway. Okay. Gave him this lyre.
Okay, I concede. You did it.
Gave him this lyre, and basically it worked. But it was some kind of double-edged sword. It's almost like a bit of a Shea Gorath move, where it bred so much jealousy among other like bardic rivals that he was slain out of frustration. So that's not like some epic heist thing, right? But it's a part of Rajin that led to that. And there's other ones, for example, there's one representing desire. Like, you know, they can represent different things. So Maik could be some sort of aspect that only represents one part of Rajin.
I mean, I kind of imagine Rajin anyway as sort of like Jim Carrey's the Riddler, like green, like the green suit with question marks and stuff, but a Khajiit, and his mane's dyed red and stuff, and same sort of attitude as well. Like when he's seducing Mephala, he's all.
I mean,
like,
to be fair, right? Like, hold on.
I'm following you.
Hold on. He also did steal a tattoo, right? Like, that's not. Like, it's not like he's all about utility. That's just almost like a funny, mischievous flex, right?
It's just a prank, bro. Yeah, well, but kind of thing. He's making YouTube videos.
Kinda.
Yeah. No, I guess. I mean, like, to stray a bit from the argument, I think the most interesting thing about Maik is to have no understanding whatsoever of what he is, and if he is some kind of god, it would be much more powerful and interesting than any of the gods you already know. Like, it'd be more closely associated with maybe a being who has achieved Kim, or is kind of like, has a connection to the dreamer, as opposed to Rajin.
I don't disagree, but I do think that at the same time, you could work with, if you were to go like, oh, connected to some deity, and then picking from the Khajiit pantheon, I feel like is a natural conclusion that's fair, I think. If there was some mysterious Nord, like, for example, in the same way that there is kind of like, you know, Hans the Fox and Pennell and the White Strake and all that kind of stuff that I believe, you know, gone through the same sort, bit different because it's not the same name, but you know what I mean, like a same sort of entity character as an aspect of sure.
Well, I think this is one of those theories that will always be a mystery, because Bethesda are never going to associate him with anyone other than themselves. You know, it's kind of like the conduit between the developers and the player, not anything that can be explained in lore.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Very divisive first question. I feel like this is a favorite theory by someone, but I think it's worthwhile discussing anyway. Silverfang says, still my favorite theory. Titus Mead II ordered his own assassination via proxy because he knew how unpopular he was and wanted the Empire to survive. Well, the reasoning behind it too is like he's obviously so comfortable about it at the end, like when he's dying and so on. And the kind of idea is perhaps he would be replaced by a popular figure, can rally against the Empire, stuff like that, or something like that, you know?
Whereas he must have just been sick of living, because couldn't you just have the decoy be assassinated? Like the one who isn't you, but everyone thinks is you, have him be killed, and then you just go off the grid. Instead, he's like, oh, no, I actually need to die. Kill me, please. Like, why not just fake your death?
I mean,
that's true, because he kind of did. Like, in the Dark Brotherhood questline, like you're saying, there was the double. Yeah. Like, there is the Emperor that you use the... It's the Jaren route, right? As you're mixing the cauldron and you're telling her to add a septum and all these little meme things that Scott absolutely loved. All of that kind of stuff and effort to have only the double, it's kind of like, well...
It's kind of like... there's a lot of... I feel like a good guy Empire sort of, like, film over it when you look at this theory and stuff. Because it's also, like, the assumption. It's like... I don't know, like, look at the Empire's past and so on, incredibly bureaucratic, lots of infighting problems, all that kind of stuff. Is it really that unbelievable? Like, what's the most common sense likely thing is that, oh, he's an unpopular emperor. The Empire's crumbling under his things. He lost Hammerfell. He signed the White Gold Concordat. There are, like, plenty reasons as to why people would want him dead or find him very unappealing as the emperor. And easily you can imagine the Elder Council, like, scheming to get rid of him, because that's kind of the implication. It's like, you know, you're paying with an Elder Council amulet. That's what your funds
and the Mortier didn't really seem like he was like in on something where it was very much like the Emperor ordered this. Like, it, you know, it felt like it genuinely came from, you know,
I mean, it would probably be like a chain
represents.
Of
yeah of course.
Proxies to if they were trying to do it, but I still feel like at the end, like you guys were saying too, it's like, why put all this effort to avoid the first assassination and then, like, you know what I mean? Like,
to play devil's advocate, it could be because the commander was trying to catch you and the emperor didn't really have a choice. Like, if the commander came to the emperor and was like, you're going to get assassinated, I think we should put a double in. You can't have the emperor, you know, who's trying to pretend to be not assassinating himself if he was, be like, oh, no, I want to be there. Don't use the double. Make me a target, you know? So then maybe it got dragged out longer than he expected.
The way at least I interpret it, it's like, it's cool and it's cool for discussion. I just feel like it's far more likely that it was just a legit assassination. At the end of his thing, he's kind of got like that acceptance of fate and has that conversation with you. And also, he orders you to kill, he asks of you to kill the person who did it, which already seems like a kind of like bitter revenge kind of thing. And what the other theory will say is like, oh, well, it was to, like, you know, tie the loose ends and stuff like that. What, you got a chance to tie the loose ends, that this Dark Brotherhood assassin to kill you might do you a favor and kill someone? It seems a very like, oh, here's a gesture, I'll do it. Do, you know, a dying old man, give him his last thing. So I don't really buy it, but shut down.
Top five worst theories. it is interesting.
It's a cool theory, but you have to do a lot of work to, you know. It
takes a bit of mental gymnastics.
Yeah, true.
A bit like the other one.
Okay, let's have a look.
A lot of the comments are talking about the Alduin theory that we were going through, like kind of adding to it, the whole theory about the Dragonborn being sent to defeat Alduin so that the world can end eventually, because Alduin wasn't, you know, sticking to his duties. Thanks for all this insight after I'm already like making my video all about it. But apparently the dragon at Kynesgrove actually says, in the dragon language, has the time come to resurrect our ancient realm? And Alduin says, yes, my champion. So, you know.
Yeah, extra. Yeah. Here's another one from Kevin. It's a three-part theory regarding Malekith, actually. So it says, here's my theory. Malekith's code outlines the way to mantle Malekith. Per the code, the son must kill a father in order to take his place as chief. Malekith is known as the Orc Father, so if an Orc, Malekith's children, became powerful enough to challenge him, they could mantle Malekith and be the new Morlock. Here's the part two. Malekith wants to be mantled. When Trinimac was eaten and defeated by Boethia, his followers changed to being the Orcs as well. The reason Malekith is so devoted to his Orcs is not out of selfishness or love. Did he mean selflessness? Or whatever, I know. But out of guilt, as it was his failure that led to their transformation. For that reason, he gave the Orcs Malekith's code, not just to help them survive in a world that hates them, but to purposefully get them strong enough to overcome and defeat him, freeing his soul from being Malekith and allowing a new, stronger Malekith to lead the Orcs to glory. Last part, and a bit wild, Boethia used to have the mantle of the pariah Daedra along with his other spheres. He was alone in praising Lorcan and despised Trinimac's popularity and sought to undo him by passing the pariah mantle to him. When Boethia and Trinimac fought, one version states that Trinimac almost made the finishing blow before he was stopped. What if Boethia wanted Trinimac to defeat him so that the pariah mantle would be passed on? With Trinimac having mantled it, Boethia turned the tables with Mephala's help to further humiliate him. It was then this precedent that set Malekith's mantle to having to be fought over and won, thus making Malekith set his code to get the Orcs to be strong enough to defeat him and claim the pariah mantle for themselves.
That is an interesting theory. There's a little bit of corn and beans action going on with with this mantle.
I was like, I was like, the hell were you talking about? What would it be?
Hey,
like I thought you were coming out.
Derail this podcast. It's time for Michael to make a comeback. That's passing on the mantle. You know what I'm saying?
Because I
didn't digest, and it came out with Trinimac. And that's an
interesting nugget of information.
Yeah, I thought you were coming out with like a similar to like, oh, the meat and potatoes of the argument or something like that. You know, like the corn and beans.
There we go, ladies
we've
and gentlemen.
We've explored a theory on the channel before about Boethia being essentially in love with Lorcan and everything Boethia does is for Lorcan, and that's why Boethia Hishi created the Khymer people kind of as a love letter to Lorcan. So the idea that he would resent being the kind of pariah, I'm not sure. Yeah, that takes some thinking about.
Something else to throw in there. Is he the only... He says he was alone in praising Lorcan. Is that true? I don't know if there are other Daedra. I feel like it's maybe it's the only one that's explicitly said at the moment, but I don't know if that's necessarily like the natural conclusion
at least,
of others.
I'd say at least among the... Of all the gods who are kind of having an influence on the people of Somerset at the time, maybe it was all very Anuic and, you know, followed those. And then Boethia comes in with that attitude and that's how the changed ones come along. But I wouldn't say that Lorcan was completely out of favor, just kind of in the whole universe at the time or in the mortal realm.
Yeah.
It is a cool theory though. Like at least the first two parts that sound...
The Malekith wants to be mantled essentially.
Yeah, basically.
That's why the Orc code.
Yeah. And to free him and things like that from that state. I mean, it's not like, obviously it's not rock solid with tons of evidence, but I mean, it's a theory, right? Like none of these things are super backed up.
No, I was going to say, if Malekith is mantled, would that free Trinimac to become Trinimac again?
Well,
and the Malekith aspect would be taken away in mantled.
Because I guess that's that point of contention, because it's that same kind of thing that, like, technically with Sheogorath was just a warped version of Jigalag until Sheogorath was mantled and then they became separate entities. So same principle, I guess, is if you go with Trinimac literally was corrupted and they aren't, there's no separation of deities. But then if someone mantles Malekith, which she wants or whatever, and then the Trinimac would be
But they
separated.
Are separate, right? Like, I mean, well, you can kind of revere Trinimac and get some kind of metaphysical
but then again,
bonus
like this,
from that, right?
Yeah.
Or you could argue, it is still a corrupted version of Malekith and you just get a different kind of feedback from said.
Baiting orcs to mantle the corruption. And essentially just take that off him and create a new god from it.
Because it doesn't mean you've got... For example, you can go to like... I think someone pointed this out and it's true. But like you can go to a shrine of a saint and you can get a blessing. Mm. It doesn't mean they're a god. You know what I mean? Like just the sort of presence of like whatever magical or metaphysical like kind of blessing or existence or stuff that exists doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, that like saint has become you know, a god literally in itself, or it could be, for example, you could think of it as like an echo of what used to be or something, and that's maybe what they're trying to reconstruct. But like, it's hard with mythology, like, to take it literally or not. And I think the one thing is too, it's sort of, there is that Orsinium dynamic where you have like people wanting Malekith versus Trinimac, and Trinimac as an attempt to sort of.
And I think the other slight problem I have with the theory, which is just my personal preference, is that I think the corruption that happened to Trinimac to turn Trinimac into Malekith became so fundamental to the identity of that god, to the point where I wouldn't say that Malekith is ashamed of those aspects, because Malekith is still very much like Trinimac, being the kind of the father figure, the paragon of strength and unity and things like that. But now it's more condensed to the people who stuck by him. So I almost feel like, from what I know of Malekith, Malekith wouldn't be rushing to get rid of that identity, probably enjoys being the god of the orcs. Because say that it does work and Trinimac does become separate from Malekith, what does Trinimac really have to be a god of anymore? Like, they abandoned him.
It's also like, too,
just,
like,
just even real quick, I was just kind of like having a little giggle over here, because I was just thinking that you were getting defensive again, like the Rajin thing, and you're like, the Malekith that I know, look, he never do that. He would never abandon.
I think we've got to argue both sides. And,
no,
I
agree.
Also, like, Malekith, even though he got, you know, Trinimac becoming Malekith became shame, but like you're sort of saying, it's like, I see more of his thing as like bitterness and like scorning others and stuff, but it doesn't necessarily mean like I would want, you know what I mean, revert or anything like that.
Yeah, would Malekith really be desperate to return to the good books of the elves who neglected him once he was covered in doo-doo? You know, I doubt it.
He's found his own identity.
Yeah. That's my take anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Here's that comment that I was talking about before the podcast started. How many roads must a man walk down before he may call some trees the dweller? I like that. By the way, the theory on Mike the Liar had a second theory in the comment, which is basically that the Night... people probably have heard this one, but that the Night of Tears was a lie created by the Atmorans to basically justify their attack on the Snow Elves and to be seen as heroes. It's funny that the theory that the idea that backs that up is basically that, and I mean, it's not the best, but the idea is that there are no snow elves to talk about it. And Gellibor basically says that, oh, we were kind of always at war, like these two sides, we always had issues. And then the Knight of Tears idea in that story is like, oh, we were at peace and we were living together and things were cool, but then the snow elves betrayed us, so we attacked and killed them. But then if Gellibor's saying, oh no, we kind of like were, like, you know, had issues all the time, it adds credit to that idea.
Unless he was talking about like the period that kind of like after the Night of Tears, because there was a whole like period of time where the snow was getting wiped
out. It just depends like how
With that theory, and this is like what kind of like bothers me a bit in everything, is that sort of people don't come at the history of Tamriel from a sort of more neutral standpoint, of because they're always trying to orchestrate that these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. So like the Atmorans must be lying about the Night of Tears to do this or something like that. Rather than seeing something like a chain of consequence, you can easily see how the Snow Elves might feel threatened, especially if there's the Heart of Magnus in there, Eye of Magnus, sorry, and all of that. So is it really that inconceivable that an elven race might do that to prevent something, but they fail to eliminate completely, and then there's going to be retribution? Like, look at all of real world history, everything. There are cycles of retribution and back and forth. Whereas, like, if you're trying to constantly go back and look for, like, this is the good guy, the bad guy, the fact is you're deluded.
Hey.
Because everyone's...
It's just a game theory, bro.
Yeah, but it is a good thing to focus on, and when you're, like, you know, trying to critically think about, like, the...
Oh, for sure. There's a lot of Atmoran cope around. 100%.
Yeah, the same is on the opposite. Like, obviously, with they're like, oh, the Atmoran, the evil snow elves, they did it completely unprovoked and yada, 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 this. Like, you don't know the minutiae of it, but then, you know, and it's obviously not the...
We do know bits and pieces of snow elven worship and religion, but we do know that Magnus is more of a god of elves than men. And, you know, on top of all the worrying about the power of these Nords growing with the Eye of Magnus, you can imagine if an elven race learns that such an artifact that you could associate with an elven god has been found on their land, they're going to be much more covetous of it and want to be in control of it. Whether or not that justifies what happens at the Night of Tears, obviously, is another matter.
That's the other thing, is when people reduce it just to the racial or cultural bounds, but it's like, you will find dissent amongst them. Like, I actually, when I wrote this, I forgot what I call it, The Fall of the Snow Prince or something like that, just a little, like, creative piece or something. But there can be the idea that some snow elves or some people within any culture might disagree with whatever political thing is going ahead, and they so... You can have different views, like, but whoever, like, ultimately, you know, it's different because it's monarchies, like, but it has the most votes or whatever, that gets through. Like, it's not exactly everyone agreeing with that. So there might have been at Morans that, like, no, we don't want to, like, go to war, yeah, or snow elves or so on. But then others do, and then they prevail and they can rile up enough. Or so it's looking at it from, like, rather than there's this giant evil monolith of at Morans, or in the reverse, a giant evil monolith of snow elves, and they did this and that, and you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I agree. It's kind of the problem with a lot of conspiracies, even in real life, is that they assume a very high level of unity and coordination, and, like, basically, like, all the different moving parts are one big part, when it's, like, there's a lot of, like, there are so many, like, thousands of factors and different people with slightly varying motives and, like, different views, and, you know, it's in a way, it's quite hard to comprehend, like, a lot of what's happening and why.
So honestly, I feel like if there really were some, like, super, like, big, like, puppeteer masters and so on, things would be going more their way, I guess, in certain things. Like, and their assumption is, like, oh, you know, there's disunity and all this, so it is going their way. Or is it actually just there are so many variables and patterns of things and stuff that can't be predicted, but then it, you know, take... Everyone's got their own sort of self-interest, then their group interest or broader interest than
I'm,
that.
Like, I'm not even, like, like, you know, conspiracy theories are interesting and, you know, sometimes they turn out to be true. It's just, like, a lot of the time it's your basic, like, I want money or, like, you know, like, and the same would happen in the Elder Scrolls universe. It could just be, like, you know, this one leader is basically, like, oh, I want, you know, to achieve X, Y, Z, so let's do it.
Yeah, it's that weird. And then the same sort of, like, well, it's tied into the culture biases and something we were talking about before. It's that weird idea. Like, for example, in the Empire, it's like, oh, the Emperor can't be a dumbass. He must have intentionally wanted to get assassinated. It's like, it's all a master plan, you know? And it's like, they do that kind of thing. They give so much uneven credit to things where me, I, like, discredit others, and it's sort of...
But, I mean, it's fun, right? It's like, that's the whole point of the theories.
Yeah. Well, plus, this happens when a community so in love with a series is starved of content for so long. We end up doing this. You know, we all do it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
No, but I 100% agree with your sentiment, though.
I think my favorite thing, though, is when you get a convincing theory that has just enough parts where it's believable. Like your theory on the Atmorans being dragons and all that. It's kind of like, you can watch that video and believe it. Like, by the end of it, you're like, that could be true. And it's backed up to enough where you can't be like, oh, that's stupid or something like that.
Do you know what I think it is, too? It's actually looking at all of the history, mythology, all of that kind of stuff without 100% certainty. So it's like, even if we're like, oh, this idea is really cool, or I even like this sort of theory, or I think it's really cool, there's still that lot of acknowledgement that it's like, oh, it could be wrong. Like, it doesn't necessarily is the case. It's like, you know, you can make theories and you know, certain judgments and stuff that are like 70% likely, like if you were to make it in a bet and odds or whatever, but you can still subjectively sort of like, yeah, I want that to be the thing, or I want like this, or I think that's a bad direction, or you know what I mean? Like, you know, I've had to think a lot about this because my like long relationship with the Ebonheart Pact, and I'm like over time just kind of, it's like, it is what it is. I accept it. It just is the thing. I don't think it's a good decision. I don't think it makes sense. But you know,
so you're against it then?
Huh?
The Ebonheart Pact. You're not a fan of the Ebonheart Pact?
I'm not a fan of it, but I accept it, if that makes sense. Yeah. You know, because there's all kinds of changes and things all throughout.
So you've gone through all the stages, you know, like grief, denial, etc.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly.
Dan B. Fan Theory. Scott, Drew and Michael are the anticipations of Todd Howard, Christopher Weaver and Michael Kirkbride, and are the new Tribunal pulling the strings of the Elder Scrolls series. I mean, I wish we were pulling the strings.
If we were pulling the strings, we'd have it out this year. Yes. No, I'm kidding.
Our best hope is like just pushing theories and like memetically sort of like, you know, putting things out there and stuff. And then people who are working at Bethesda are like, oh, there's actually the community's got these really cool ideas or whatever or something like that. And then like pushing those forward, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the best we can do, I think.
Mm. There is that comment about the orc dwarf thing. I don't know if you want to get into that or not.
Oh, okay. So actually, this is actually, it's just an insight that I feel like it's just an, so for a while I've had like, and we've talked about it ages ago, the whole like Dwemer equal orc kind of theory, or that they're related some sort of intrinsic way or something. And I like, there's a lot of coincidences, but I'm like, oh, it's never enough. But I think this also just helped me like sort of, I am writing the script, so I'm actually going to do it. And I don't know if you'll even, if it's even convincing by the end, but there's just so much like interesting evidence to sort of like tie together and talk about. But Zach says, every time Malakath and Volendrung are brought up, people seem to think it's a coincidence slash random that the Orc God King lays claim over an artifact that is Dwemer in origin. I think it's actually quite fitting if you look at the story of the Rorkan clan. The creators of Volendrung, the Rorkan clan, had left Morrowind for Hammerfell in a self-imposed exile since they refused to join the First Council with the Khaimah. In doing so, they became the outcasts slash pariahs of the Dwemer people. Volendrung is pretty integral to the story of the Rorkan clan and could be seen as a symbol for the Dwarven outcasts. Once the dwarves disappeared, the hammer was put into Malakath's possession, since he had the strongest association with his sphere, giving him a metaphysical dibs to the artifact. Also, since Daedric artifacts are supposed to embody the sphere of its respective Daedric prince, I doubt the other 15 princes would have wanted it. Anyway. But yeah, it is a sort of like... interesting extra thing to think about, the importance of Volendrung. And while it's not... The previous references are more so about like Dumak, and I think it's like across. He basically dwarf orc is the thing. It's Dumak dwarf orc or Dumalakath, the full like name, but it's in two different cultures. In I think it's Khajiit and Nord, he gets called Dumalakath, and then in across the Dunmer as well. In all three of them, he gets called dwarf orc as well. So it's a very prominent title, and it's not just like, oh, just a little bit of Nordic flavor or a little bit of this, you know. And there's interesting, you'll just, I guess, I'll have to wait for like the actual like
video
spiel on that. But I do like the idea that it does help make a bit more sense for the Volendrung mm-hmm. acquisition.
Mm-hmm. There is a comment from Judith Creamer who says, Alduin choosing domination over destruction was Akatosh's plan all along. As the chief deity of multiple pantheons, Akatosh is arguably the most powerful god. In order to keep his place at the top, he purposely fails to end the Kalpa for fear it will reduce his power. This would explain why he intervenes in Oblivion to thwart Mehrunes Dagon, and in Skyrim by sending a dragonborn to stop Alduin. He wants to keep his place at the top, but has to put in a token effort to end the Kalpa, so he sabotages himself to keep it going. I don't know if I fully agree with that. If the idea is that Alduin kind of isn't there to end the world, like, he wouldn't really be... I get the premise... And also, in Oblivion, it's... I don't know if it's Akatosh intervening as much as it's just, like, the amulet has his power kind of, like, in it, and Martin uses it. Like,
there's a few awkward things about that, yeah. Because, like, obviously, we have the whole dynamic of how much power do the Aedra actually have after committing their power to creating the Mundus. And then if you've got this idea that Akatosh can get involved, which we kind of have seen can happen... Why would Alduin exist in the first place if Akatosh doesn't want the world to end? Unless you've got the idea that Alduin kind of ascended to the role of being the firstborn of Akatosh and the World Eater, like unbeknownst to Akatosh, if that makes
sense. I guess it does align with the insane god theory, though, that like he doesn't know what he wants, and there's multiple aspects. Like,
One thing to consider, too, is that, like, you know, there's the kind of idea that as each Kalpa go by, there might be a sort of, like, you know, the Dawn War kind of each time establishes kind of, like, who's on top or who's prevalent this time around kind of thing. Like, you know, so some gods might be vying for more strength or power or so on. But if you stop envisioning Akatosh at this oversoul idea and instead actually envision that perhaps you've got ideas of, like, Alduin was, like, the Akatosh time god feeling of the last one, or say it was Auriel or something instead, but then they're kind of like on the cycle, they're kind of all still existing at the same time, but like maybe that their interests go along differently. Like Akatosh might feel like he's not going to be dominant in the next Kalpa or the dominant part of it, so he doesn't want to, maybe that's why he helped Alduin
do his thing or whatever in an effort to prolong it or something, so that Auriel doesn't become the emergent sort of dominant part of the next cycle or something. You know what I'm kind of getting at?
Right, so you're kind of getting more at the idea that Akatosh, as like an aspect of the Akka Oversoul, would want to maintain power over other aspects of itself rather than Akatosh / Auriel versus Lorcan, like not wanting Lorcan to win that kind of Dawn War.
Yeah, kind of like, because, I mean, also if you look, it depends, like if there is that idea that Akatosh has some Lorcanic elements, like, you know, Empire of Man, like the depiction mm-hmm. of the dragon and the man, and you've talked about that before and so on, the, like, you know, Lorcan, the real god of the empire kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If Akatosh really is, like, if you envisioned it more so as, like, when Alicia's conceiving it, it is a synthesis of Auriel and Shaw, yeah. kind of, and putting them together, you get this new being, but this new being doesn't exist. Shaw's whole like thing or their pantheon had like Alduin as the end or Auriel as the beginning, but this new synthesis combination kind of leads to a middle, but the middle doesn't exist if there's a beginning or an end, so it kind of wants to prolong itself.
And actually, yeah, that does kind of perfectly explain the contradictions between Akatosh simultaneously seeming to want to prolong the world and end it. It's like the two heads of that dragon, the dragon face and the man face that you see in depictions mm. of Akatosh, are warring over whether to end it or whether to keep it going. So Akatosh, like Auriel, would absolutely want it to end, and Shaw would absolutely want it to continue. But when you've got both of them as Akatosh, it's like, yeah, this kind of insanity, this duo of wanting to end and maintain it simultaneously.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's too also, it's like if you also think too of like, even if you were just to keep it to the entities themselves, instead of, you know, that whole Akatosh insane thing, if you do just have like, you know, full like DID kind of thing, if you have the Akatosh might be wary and kind of have knowledge of the other personalities and not want it to happen or something like that. They don't want Auriel to, you know, like, have you seen the movie Split when you know, who wants to come into the light or whatever? But he knows who Auriel is. He doesn't want Auriel to come into, well, or Alduin to come into the light and end the world. So then, because otherwise, I don't know, he's got to wait his turn to Alduin or Auriel or whatever. It's also, this is so abstract to talk about because we don't understand Kalpas or anything. And by the way, like, as much as it's a compelling theory, the whole Akatosh is insane. Like, the whole Akka Oversoul, as much as people like to talk about it in the community and like forums and stuff, as if it is like indisputed canon, it's not. Mm. As far as I'm concerned, the only real canon sort of vibe is that there is a time god and there is Auriel as the elven interpretation, Alduin as Nords, and Akatosh as this sort of synthesis. And then there's obviously Alkosh and other things, but they're all interpretations of a time god rather than this sort of... You'll also find that no one ever talks about Alkosh or like Ruptgar, like Tor Papa, when they're talking about the Akka Oversoul. It's really just these three things, these three interpretations only, because they neatly fit into their...
It's a small thing you said, but I like how you said it's like the canon vibe. It's like, we're only in Elder Scrolls can canon kind of be a vibe. It's like, yeah, that canon? Is that not canon? Oh, I'm not sure if I'm vibing it.
Yeah.
All right, next theory, boys. I don't have one. I need you to get one.
Can you make my lunch, Mom? Okay, it is another one by EJ Dubs. Theory: Chaedon Hall is the de facto center of power for House Laloo in the Fourth Era. Count Indaris had Laloo ties, and we see an Indaris leading forces in the novels circa 40 Fourth Era. This puts them in a strong position to retake control of Morrowind should the Empire regain strength. I do, at least at the very part of that, I agree that there's a good chance, and I would imagine, and this is kind of what I actually used as part of for the Deathweaver build. The backstory was that Chaedon Hall had grown almost into like a slum, this huge influx of Laloo with people abandoning all the Fall of the Tribunal, and then also Red Mountain and Argonian invasion afterwards. And over time, I called it like a big slum, like on the side of Chaedon Hall called New Narsis or something, like growing out. But I think that, and especially same thing, there was those Laloo ties and so on. And because that's really what Laloo are at the time of the Third Era. They are just like essentially imperialized Dunmer. So that little middle ground there, it is probably a safe place for them to grow, you know, within the bounds of the Empire, and they can probably prosper and as they could, and also become a dominant demographic. Like, I would imagine just naturally, if you look at all border cities, like Windhelm, Riften, and Chaedon Hall should have a decent Dunmer influx.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, center of powerhouse slowly, but they probably
could it, maybe it yeah. could be, you know, a place of power for sure, or like yeah. a place of where they'll.
I mean, I if you guys see it in the comments, take over from me because I don't have it open, so I don't want to butcher it. But I did see a theory that was essentially saying the heart of Lorcan is the reason that Morrowind is the most alien of the provinces.
Hmm, okay.
Yeah, I saw that one.
So, I mean, like, my first reaction to that was, I mean, obviously there are alien elements described in all over Tamriel and away from Tamriel, like, you know, look at Akavir, or even look at Somerset. The way Somerset was described is very alien. So it, in a way, it does just come down to the natural flora and architectural yeah. style it's- of the races. But then there is also the argument to be made that, I think we've talked about this before, that because the heart of Lorcan kind of, it's essentially the heart of the world and the lava that the magma that flows under Red Mountain and in the subterranean depths of Tamriel is kind of like the flowing blood of the dead god. So the idea that where the closer you are to that, the more kind of like Padamaic power exists and exudes from it is possible.
The only thing there is just kind of things like, you know, like Black Marsh looks far more alien than Skyrim, but like mm-hmm. in proximity to the heart of Lorcan, like Skyrim I guess... would be there. And I think it ultimately comes down to is anything around this is going to be it's cope lore to cope with design changes, because as Morrowind sort of that era of Morrowind, the rest of Elder Scroll like was envisioned a much more, you know, alien and weird. Like even if they were just
but
like
to be know. To be fair, I mean this is kind of obvious, but you know, being like the comment says, like as well, like being the personification of chaos, it would make sense that land made by him would be more alien and chaotic. But I do think they're different. Like what, like alien is from a reference point, right? Like just because Morrowind has a giant bug that you can yeah. ride, doesn't mean that that's like chaos. It's just like they ride giant bugs. It's weird to you if you're not from there.
Yeah,
but if you're born there, it'd be quite orderly. You know, I get on my silt strider and I go around and I'm here at this time or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's yeah. not inherently like chaotic and crazy just because it is like to us, like giant mushrooms. Like, okay, it's just their, you know, part of their
yeah.
their
but flora. I guess what
chaotic too. Like, if you want to look at chaotic, there's plenty of provinces that have seen heaps of chaos.
Yeah, but I guess what they're just saying is because of the way that everything's envisioned now, everywhere else in Tamriel ultimately looks more like Europe or Asia.
But
or
like
something.
Like you said, Black like, Marsh is pretty alien looking.
Yeah, they have.
I'm sure the coral kingdoms of Thras and all that are all very like strange and
there's creatures and flavor like Welwars and Somerset or something yeah. like they throw in their flavor. They have that's why at the end of the day, it's not really like. It's cope for that they design changes along.
Plus, and if you're talking about it being inhospitable as well, obviously being the only active volcano in Tamriel, the craglands is going to make sense just purely on that biome, you know.
So, yeah, like unique feature that creatures yeah. and flora will adapt to mm-hmm. because nowhere else has ash storms and
yeah,
stuff like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to shout out this comment by Gabezilla that timestamps 24:35 on the last theory episode. Shout out. Shout out to my man being the nice guy and creating an interdimensional portal to scratch Scott's ear. I actually watched it. You like go like this and then like Scott's hand comes and does
Oh, really? I didn't even notice that.
Nah, it's good. Go check that out. Shout out.
I reckon we could probably finish off on another one because this was a fairly long one. It depends how long we talk about this. But here's a crazy theory from Sterling Arnold that he's come to accept as canon, by the way. Mm. So, the Kalpic cycle is a lie. Mm. According to Redguard mythology, Rupta created Sep from the remnants of dead world skins, and Sep created the Mundus in his own image, an undead god creating an undead world. It's important to understand that Sep created his skin ball separate from Satakal, no longer beholden to its hunger. It is why the Red Guards no longer have access to the walkabout, as it is was a technique created to traverse Satak scales. In my understanding, then, Lorcan or had always intended for the Mundus to be the final Kalpa. It's the reason the gods are so adamant on continuing the current cycle and why Alduin refuses his original role. There is no next world to replace this one, once it's gone. I also believe that Mundus's creation and the breaking of the 12 worlds are the same event, as it is referring to the breaking of the cycle, as well as the coalescence of the remains of the worlds that came before. The origin of the races may also be a result of them being saved from this breaking, such as Kyne breathing the Nords onto the throat of the world, or the Aldmer losing Aldmeris and finding themselves on the Somerset Isles. Perhaps this time is also perceived as the Ooze by the Wood Elves.
Hmm.
Actually, that's a pretty cool theory.
Yeah, there's a lot to go into there. I mean, just as a small note, we obviously, when it comes to something like Kalpa, it's really hard to actually have any evidence, proper evidence that a Kalpa exists, because the whole idea is that it resets the cycle. But obviously we do have plenty of evidence of worlds being unmade or destroyed or coming to an end without necessarily a new cycle beginning, whereas we don't have much evidence of the cycle renewing. You know, say, so say you've got the 12 worlds of creation from the Anuad that are all destroyed, and then you've got, say, Lig, which is unmade by that's how it's insinuated anyway, is that it's unmade by Maerun's Dagon and the slaves. But yeah, evidence for the cycle.
What if you
less.
Imagined the 12 worlds as previous cycles or something like that? Just stick with cycles mm-hmm. for a moment. But then there is, like, you know, there's the Lig, there's Eldmeris, there's the sort of Nords that were, like, maybe saved from their world and, like I said, breathed onto to Skyrim at that time later. And there's all these different worlds and maybe where the Hist are from and something. And all of those, you know, they eventually are remnants of previous apocalypses that have happened, you know, when the Kalpic cycle starts. They break the cycle, and now all of the, you know, refugees, so to say, of that, or leftovers have been found there. So that's why also, like, there's this sort of mythical Aldmeris, which doesn't necessarily exist as a place, but they're just cast onto these ships and they found their place, or Nords breathed onto the world, or, you know, I mean, the Hist are surviving. Well, the Argonians are, like, you know, little computers for the Hist, like little robots for the Hist, right? So the Hist survived this breaking and stuff. It's interesting to think of that, because I, when I heard 12 worlds in the Anuad, I always think of it as, like, just a creation story about all these different worlds and then smashed together, but actually envisioning them as a world, as is in a Kalpic cycle.
So the next one's Nirn.
Well, the final one's known, and that's what this one is getting.
Well,
if that's to go.
Yeah, but if there was a new cycle, it could have, like, you know, some story in it about this world called Nirn. Just interesting to think.
I feel like if there was significance to these 12 worlds, there would be, the number 12 wouldn't just be a coincidence. There would be an explanation for each one. But I feel like it was kind of just an offhanded creation story.
Mm. It's interesting. What do you think of the Wood Elf things too? Because, like, you know, the Wood Elf, like the Ooze, like, you know how we're finding a lot of new ESO stuff is there's lots of contradictions about people's place in the world and when they came and stuff like that, and it doesn't all fit in nicely with this old Elven story. But, like, it's kind of weird, and this is how we got to, like, you talk about the Elder Scrolls and stuff. It's kind of hard because a lot of theories and stuff are built out of trying to literalize comparative mythology. Like, you're trying to get all of the creation stories to make sense and line up, because there is magic and there are, like, real evidence for, like, godly beings, but then there's also the interpretation, all that stuff backwards. So it's a weird space of, like, you know, it's kind of hard to figure out. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know, what do you guys think? Like,
I mean, when I think of the Red Guard story of having the kind of the dead world skins that he's rolled into a ball to create Mundus, it, as you were kind of getting at, is it's more of a metaphor for him kind of taking ideas, the ideas of creation when all these spirits are finding their place, and formulating the idea for this realm, as opposed to it literally being the kind of salvation of these dead worlds being brought together. It's hard to justify that, because I feel like there isn't a whole lot to support it. But at the same time, this is the first time I'm hearing this. So,
what if, though, when the world ends, this kind of skin ball just unravels and he can just, like, put it together into a new world? Like, why does it have to be like the?
I mean, that's kind of the idea that we were getting at with Lig and adjacent places. Is that they were other attempts by Lorcan to make this kind of experimental realm, the mortal realm, and sometimes it fails. You know, in this instance, it failed with Lig.
Find it interesting, though, the whole skinball thing, the building separate, because remember, it's the idea that the kind of idea there, I guess, what's on Mundus is that there is that Kalpic thing, the Satakal eating itself. So that would be one cycle in itself. Everything gets destroyed unless you learnt the walkabout and those gods could move between them. So only the highest beings. But then the skinball as an alternative or an easier way to do it, but like creating it out of the detritus or whatnot, making that place, it's like envisioning that as only a thing, like Mundus, as only a now thing, like previous Kalpas was some other kind of incomprehensible world or cycle or whatever, adjacent place, whatever. But now is the final time. It's like, oh, this is the attempt to actually stop it. Maybe like this is Lorcan sort of put his foot down. Is that enough?
I mean, it could be. It could be.
I because this is the thing too. And it's like sometimes to keep you on your toes, but always like challenge some of the more fundamental theories and liked, cherished theories and stuff that exist around and so on. It's the same as you can go like, oh, there's the Towers theory, but then walk it back and stuff, because you can criticize that for being, oh, it's perfectly convenient, isn't there's like the, you know, the 16 spokes or and the 8 spaces and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, this perfectly aligned wheel, it's a very nice neat cosmology or like thing, but there's so many examples of things that exist outside of it.
Yeah. So, and I mean, I feel like the idea isn't, it's not mutually exclusive, the idea that it could be a cycle, but also kind of a fresh start, because that's the whole idea of this walkabout, is that the powerful deities, the gods, can like learn to step aside and dodge the destruction, which would make sense when you've got the new Dawn era where all the gods come in first, and then you've got, I guess you kind of pull, the idea is that you pull the souls from the afterlives, from the Dreaming Sleeve, and they populate this new realm. So in a way, it is a new cycle, but it is also something completely new. So they're kind, it's kind of synonymous in a sense.
I'm ready for the next one.
You're ready for the next one? Monsieur, the Kalpic cycle.
Monsieur Dorgat says, theory I'm quite proud of. Molag Bal's driving emotion is insecurity and fear that he gained when Mehrunes Dagon brought him low in Lig, possibly tormenting him as well. Molag Bal is an archetype of the abuser whose abuse creates more abusers, in brackets vampires. This type of personality very typically comes from the contextual nexus of entitlement and insecurity, when one feels deep down that they're not as strong as they should be, but also feeling that they can resolve this problem by demonstrating their power over others. Molag Bal is defined by all the behaviors bullies and spousal abusers do. A great example is when you best him, he actually backs down. I think he's afraid of anyone who can actually stand up to him from the last time he was humbled by an upstart. In the 36 lessons of Vivek, we learn that Molag Bal wants love and feels deeply unloved. Vivek then proceeds to seduce Molag Bal only to insult, and casts away Bal after Vivek reveals he was only trying to steal the secret of Kim. It makes me wonder if his theorized relationship with Azura in Lig had a similar vibe. When Bal was assaulted by Dagon, Azura left him because she is self-centered. Bal may have become the king of rape because he has never had a healthy consensual relationship.
I think that's actually a pretty beast theory. Yeah. It's less theory, more analysis, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, kind of like demonstrating why he is the way he is, because he is a fairly one-note prince if you just boil it down to what he represents. Mm. So as a way of kind of analyzing and justifying, well, not justifying, but explaining the way he is, it all of that makes sense to me.
Yeah. I feel like he's commented this and it's going to be very underwhelming, because I'm like, yeah, actually, that's a really good insight. That's about it. Like, I don't know what I could add to that really or anything, but I think that's a pretty comprehensive sort of...
I feel like we could make a video on that and like dive into it deeper. We'll give credit, of course.
Mm.
Yeah, I always like when you can get like more insight or different ways of thinking about something that, you know, you could look at Molag Bal and go, oh, he's the devil. He's the one-dimensional domination prince, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting to sort of...
Because you can kind of apply some of that logic to just about every prince, in that like they brag about the fact that they didn't invest their power in creating the mortal realm, but they're constantly trying to seek validation from the inhabitants of this realm, as if they do feel like they were left out of what is essentially kind of described as being the center of the universe. The Mundus is kind of the culmination point, the arena, the most important part. And these Daedra are more powerful. They can get involved, but at the end of the day, they're not the creators. They're bystanders. So they are kind of desperately in need of attention. And that kind of ties into what was said about Molag Bal wanting to be loved.
Almost makes you feel sorry for him.
Only a little bit.
Yeah, he can't really justify all the stuff he's been doing.
Molag Bal apologists.
All right.
Any more hot theories? I guess to the future to say as well, guys, is absolutely go in for analysis. Like, I guess they're all for theory analysis kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a theoretical analysis or something. But yeah, those two feel free to drop those
down. And let's be very clear too. Put your theories below this podcast episode. And if we don't say it or didn't say it, just write it again if you think it's really good and back it up harder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you want me to, like, I can drop one more theory.
All right, one more theory. Because
it's another theory. It's theory / take. It all kind of blends. But the Morag Tong are finished. They were first created as a way of preserving the balance of power between the great houses. By the time of Skyrim, Hlaalu has stripped them of their status. Dress and Telvanni have been decimated by the Argonians, and Indoril has lost most of their power after the fall of the Tribunal. Redoran, meanwhile, not only stayed strong, but amassed more power and influence by pushing back the Argonians, making them the dominant power in Morrowind. Then in the Dragonborn DLC, Hlaalu hires the Morag Tong to assassinate a Redoran counselor, and Redoran responds by killing the assassin and the people who hired them, despite the fact what Hlaalu did was completely, like, legal. I guess all this stuff's kind of changed without the Tribunal and power structures of before, and literally what the Morag Tong are supposed to be used for. Redoran even say that the Tong are pure evil and disgusting and should never be used, despite Redoran being the ones who believe the most in local Dunmer traditions. They're only saying this now because they're the ones in control and the Tong are a potential threat. Now they have enough power to sway or convince the rest of the Dunmer to abandon them. I can't help but draw comparisons between this and the Tribunal and Azura. But, I mean, I 100% kind of agree. Like, Morag Tong's days are, like, far behind them. Like, I kind of almost like it. It's, like, a nice conclusion, I guess, that they have kind of just become, like Raven Rock kind of says, like, filthy assassins that just do stuff for money. And also why that Thieves Guild guy, like, left and stuff like that. The idea that there is a downfall of it. Because there's these vague ideas. Oh, we'll reband someday, But with Redoran, you may as well look, the way at least I feel about it when looking at House Morrowind in general, is that House Redoran is functionally like the monarchy, like an autocracy. It's like, is the power. I think a lot of the other houses feel very small, new or something like, you know what I mean? Like, it's very dominant.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It makes sense. You know, with a group like the Dark Brotherhood where it's a bit more surface level. It's kind of just assassination for the sake of it. Well, obviously, I'm oversimplifying that, but the Morag Tong, as we've discussed a lot, it's much more integral to Dunmer society in that, yeah, it's like Mafala's idea of using political assassination. As I said, politically, like, it's important to maintain a balance, but yeah, there is no balance anymore. And when you have one dominant class, one dominant house, yeah, it doesn't really have a purpose. So that does make total sense, yeah.
And I think even the big ideas of councils and houses and stuff, a lot of this also existed under Tribunal stuff. I think in a lot of the ways, they're like, the Dunmer's fate is to revert to a more of a Kaima sort of tradition, you know what I mean? Like an old, like, a different religion. Because, like, under the Tribunal, things are different for a long time. But I guess the whole Mafala, Morag Tong thing is that kind of tradition. But, yeah. Anyways...
Okay, I guess that brings us to the end.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, social media links are in the description, as is a link to our Patreon if you want to help support this podcast and the channel in general. It's been Scott, Michael, and Drew, and we look forward to nerding out with you again very soon.